meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey, welcome everyone. God bless you for tuning into The Winds of Change. It's a Wednesday. If you're listening live, that means you're with Father Tom Coyce for a Brain Wrinkling Wednesday, or a Brain Wrinkling podcast, whatever day or hour you're listening to. God bless you. So happy to be on the EWTN network. I hope you keep either 88.5 FM or 95 AM. What am I saying? 750 AM. What am I talking about? 750 AM WNDZ on your speed dial. Check in on those two radio channels frequently. You'll hear a lot of good EWTN programming. Here we are in the greater Chicagoland. I'm Father Tom Coyce, and I want to continue something I just started. I think it was last week. Of course, Pope Benedict was called to his eternal reward. We pray he pass swiftly through whatever purgatory he may have needed and is enjoying eternal bliss of heaven. Even the mentioning of the word purgatory is important these days because it is denied so much and it's not even considered. Yeah, that's a crazy thing to have to say, but I had to say it. What I want to do, and I want to follow up on what Pope Francis said in his sermon at that funeral, how Pope Benedict was a man who was in love with pursuing the truth. He was a humble theologian. And so I want to review a very interesting article he wrote after he resigned, and Pope Francis, one of his first things he did was to try to address the clergy sex abuse issue. A number of people were saying people were trying to throw Pope Benedict under the bus, as it were, saying that it was all his fault. I really don't like when such a huge problem it's attempted to put the blame on one person.
Danger, Will Robinson.
Big problems
danger,
like this.
Will Robinson.
Yeah, that is a danger. And too many fall into it, of course, and I don't want to fall into that. Often these big societal, big problems, there is plenty of guilt to go around. And even though there maybe have been some wrongdoings, and some of the hierarchy, we'll say, there's certainly a lot of wrongdoings in the lower hierarchy.
It's very
as well.
I'm sorry.
All
you
of us common folks.
He's protesting.
Are going to learn
yeah.
to be more professional. That's what you're going to do.
Well, right. We do have to be more professional, not only on this wonderful radio station, but also in our ecclesial life, our civil life, our family life, et cetera, right? So anyways, this is, I want to analyze at least the first of three sections of this rather long letter that Benedict wrote So here's what, at the invitation of Pope Francis, the presidents of the world's bishops' conferences gathered in Rome to discuss the crisis facing the church, especially the revelations of the clerical sex abuse against minors. The extent and gravity of the reported incidents has deeply distressed priests as laity as well, caused more than a few to call into question the very faith of the church. It was necessary to send out a strong message and seek out a new beginning, so to make the church again credible in the light, as a light among the people and as a force of service against the powers of destruction. So here's what Pope Benedict says: since I myself had served in a position of responsibility as shepherd of the church at that time of the public outbreak of the crisis, and during the run-up to it, I had to ask myself, even though as emeritus, I'm no longer directly responsible, what I could contribute to a new beginning. I want to pause for a second and just analyze this little phrase, during the run-up to it. That is a mouthful, my friends. The run-up to it is long, and it involves everyone. And it's a slow degrading of moral principles, and that's really what Pope Benedict is going to try to focus on. He's going to get pretty philosophical and theological, and analyzing his words are going to be frustrating for some people because they are philosophical and theological, and we're not really interested in reasons. We want results. We want to see something change. As a matter of fact, one of the great insights of human nature that I think many of us operate under, we should operate under, is the fact that the majority of people are not deeply philosophical or theologically inclined. We look for results, we see consequences, we want better consequences, we want better results, and we don't really probe the reasons, or you could say the philosophy, the philosophical things going on that do the running up to such a crisis, as it were. And we can say that the sexual abuse crisis is a crisis. It bubbled over. But just like in the physical world, you have a pot that's on the stove and it boiled over. The reason it boiled over is because the heat was left on too much, right? There's always a reason. There's always those facts. And unless and until you get to those facts, you're going to have more and more such catastrophes or crises, as it were. And in the moral realm, in the spiritual world, that getting to the cause, reaching for the button or the dial that dials down the heat is where philosophy and theology comes in. And exercising special discipline, moral lifestyle, especially lifestyle changes. So
you just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, that's brain wrinkling indeed, is it not? I'm going to take the first part, and I doubt if I'll get to the second part because it's so hard to unpack, as it were. Benedict, again, I'm using this in the wake of knowing that Pope Benedict just passed away, but his words have not passed away. And as a matter of fact, his words have to come to life. Now, if we didn't listen to him when he was alive, we should listen to him now. Again, this is a letter that Benedict wrote to Francis and all the presidents of the bishops' conferences of the world. There's only one head of a bishops' conference in the United States, every country would have its bishops' conference, and so those are key movers and shakers, right? Yes, indeed. So he's writing this, and he even said that he wanted the Pope to bless his efforts to give a few thoughts, and Francis agreed. You know, so he didn't block it. So he wrote what he wanted to share, and we should analyze this because it really points out a huge issue that affects us all, of course. And even if we could get beyond sex abuse issues involving priests with minors, there will be other issues that will arise that can be attributed to the problems that are pointed out to here by Benedict. So he says the matter begins, now we'll go to his letter, the matter begins with the state prescribed and supported introduction of sex education. The state prescribed, you know, and I'm sure many people have been hearing religious fanatics complain about sexual morality, sex ed in schools for a long time. A lot of parents considered those complaints nothing, or complaints only of religious fanatics and not to be really worried about. You know, we're talking back in the 60s and 70s where sex ed was beginning to be introduced, obviously not only in Germany, but throughout the world. Pope Benedict, of course, being German, is using his experiences from Germany. But you gotta see the roots of our problems today. Now, the complaints, the problems we have with transgenderism and approbation of homosexual relations and marriages and experimenting with your sexuality that is almost, it's quite encouraged, is part of the flower, if you want to call it a flower, or the weed from which the roots that get their energy from the roots, right? So anyways, he remembers there was a minister in Germany, a minister of health by the name of Ms. Kate Strobel, and she introduced pornography into sex education. And at first, it was only intended for sexual education, but it quickly became widely accepted as a feasible option. That's what Pope Benedict is writing. Similar effects were achieved by an Austrian sex education school official, where they commonly used pornographic movies in schools in order to teach sex education. They so that he's pointing that out as something within the culture that's going to snowball into a problem that he, even as popes, as the Pope, and as Cardinal Ratzinger, of course, before he was Pope, that it was rolling out of control. And he's going to get to in a minute, the Catholic theologians who made their own contributions, they didn't necessarily show pornographic movies in their sex education classes, but they taught errors that what Pope Benedict says is rendered the church unable to fight it. It's an interesting way to think of it, right? So so in this first part of his letter, he's just giving his experience of the outgrowth of the 60s, we could say, the sexual freedom of the 60s. He says, I still remember seeing, as I was walking through the city of Regensburg, one day, crowds of people lining up in front of a large cinema, something we had previously only seen in times of war when some special allocation was to be hoped for. In other words, the newsreels would hopefully show some good news about what the war is, how the war is going.
Wow. You just wrinkled my brain, man.
That's definitely brain wrinkling for him. So he also remembers arriving in the city on Good Friday in 1970 and seeing all the billboards plastered up with large posters of two completely naked people embracing. So he's like, what's going on here? You wouldn't have accepted that. And of course, we could see, I'm sure many of you who are listening can add your own little comments. How did you react? What did you see? There's a kind of like, it's kind of nasty, but I can't really say too much. I don't want to appear too prudish. And therefore, you just look the other way and you just hope for the best, I guess you might say. So he says this was a new sense of freedom in the revolution of 1968. It's interesting that he uses that date, isn't it? The revolution of 1968, which sought to fight for an all-out sexual freedom, one which no longer conceded any norms. Now, back in 1968, if you know a little bit of Catholic history, or even American history, or shall we say, history of rock and roll. Of course, now I listen to the music of the 60s, and those are like the family-friendly songs, right? They're not as explicit, they're not as... But they are certainly introducing some new attitudes about relationships. Someday I'll have to have a show on all that. How did some of the fun 60s songs, they were pushing the envelope, obviously, you know, and it made the singers that you like just make what was previously a taboo or previously a publicly recognized sin, as not only not a sin, but those who would be opposed to it as the bad guys. You know, so anyways, let's take our first break, okay? And we're going to go to the deeper theological quagmire that Benedict is trying to focus the bishops and the Pope's attention, Pope Francis's attention, onto what the past few decades have done. And when you listen to him, you might be tempted to say he's looking for excuses for the sexual abuse. There could have been, should have been greater disciplinary acts, as it were. And I think he would admit that, of course. But in this letter, he's trying to get people to think more philosophically, theologically, especially in the areas of moral theology. And this is close to my heart because when I was in the seminary and studied, I sort of focused more on moral theology than history or doctrinal matters, things. Apologetics. There's different aspects, biblical theology, as it were. So I felt like as he's talking about these issues and how they were going on, I just like, ooh, I was living through that in the world of academia vis-a-vis church world church world's academia. So it is quite significant to put our attention to it. So anyways, let's take our first break. Okay, Nick? I'm Father Tom Boyce, guest host on The Winds of Change. And you're listening to the new EWTN Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland. We are WSFI 88.5 FM and WNDZ AM 750.
St. Stanislaus Koska Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Koska Academy is conveniently located one block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststandschicago.org. ststandschicago.org.
I'm Father Tom Coyes, Winds of Change guest host, and you are listening to The Winds of Change.
Sometimes it's tough to hear Winds of Change over the air. What with tall buildings, power lines, and other static. Now you can hear Winds of Change anywhere, anytime, or on any device. When Winds of Change is on the air Monday through Friday, noon to 1, go to ststandschurch.org. Scroll down to the Winds of Change tile and click on the Listen Live button, or visit Winds of Change Facebook page to see the Listen Live link.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. I'm wrinkling your brain by sharing with you a very obscure letter, but I think a very important letter that Pope Benedict the 16th wrote early on in Pope Francis's pontificate. It was a letter addressed not to the Pope, but to the bishops who are heads of the Catholic conferences of the different nations of the world. And he opens his remarks with just the reminiscence of how in the public square sexual images were becoming commonplace, as it were. He makes an interesting link too, because he says that this phenomenon, together with its mental collapse, was linked to a propensity for violence. Now, there's a connection that I often am curious about, but I wonder if you, as a listener or a consumer of news, consider much. As a consumer of news, we're often assaulted with many stories of violence in the street, violence in homes, wars, of course. And whenever I hear a robbery, some kind of violent act, I often wonder, and I would love to talk to a police officer who was there, who interviewed the people involved. Were there love triangles involved? Were there deceptions involved? Double crosses, infidelity, wrong expectations? Was there faithfulness in their relationships, et cetera? I find it very logical, and some might find it silly, but I find it very wise. You know, there's different kinds of health insurance programs out there, and there are some of these Christian-based health insurance companies, which I'm very glad that they're there. Health insurance, of course, is such a key thing, and it's to try to keep costs down. I'm often asked to sign a letter because these Christian health programs want to make sure that the person taking out a policy is a practicing Christian. So number of times people will ask me to sign a letter that says, oh, yes, so-and-so is a practicing member of our church. But not only does it say is a practicing member of the church, it says, as far as you know, does the person engage in sexual activity outside of marriage? And you might say, well, why or who has a right to ask that? You know, when you go into a hospital, you have to sign all these papers because there's so many rights and privacy rights of the patient and rights of the hospital, et cetera. And that kind of approach to a health policy would be considered verboten. How can they possibly do that? Well, it's independent of the government, and it's administered by Christians who are going to include Christian principles. And one of those Christian principles would be marriage, obviously. So, but Pope Benedict is linking the sexual revolution of the 60s to the increase in violence. And he says he even remembers on airplanes, though pornographic movies were shown in schools, grade schools even, on airplanes they were prohibited. There had to be a law passed that you can't show such X-rated movies on an airplane because violence would break out. Strange, isn't it? You could just see that as passions are excited, not only the physical passions of the body in that sense, but passions of anger, passions of jealousy, passions of rudeness, and all the rest. So I think he's onto something, and I share this with you because, like I say, when you listen to a news story, next time you hear of a domestic abuse, you talk to most police officers, and they just loathe. They don't like those domestic abuse calls that they so often get, and of course, a lot of those arguments are amongst people who are not, I'll just say, how shall we say, living the purest Christian lives. Sometimes, of course, there may be, but a lot of times it's not. So these are trends, obviously, and there's exceptions to all these things, but Pope is trying to get the world to see, to look at the mirror a little more clearly, right? So he's going on to say, the extensive collapse of the next generation of priests in those years, the very high number of laicizations were a consequence of all these developments. At one point, I remember reading an article that the Pope Benedict was depressed because he had to laicize 400 priests in one year. There are just lots of applications for laicization. And of course, that in itself is not a sexual abuse issue. Of course, all the Protestant ministers would say it's about time that the Catholic Church woke up and let priests get married. But it points to a sense of a change in vocation or a loss of vocation. And he's going to get to that when it comes to a loss of the role of martyrdom in our moral philosophy. Now, that's an interesting connection. Okay, but before we get to that, let's go on. So he's going to point out some important aspects that have happened in the Catholic academic world. He says that the Catholic moral theology suffered a collapse and rendered the church defenseless against these changes in society. And I will try to outline briefly the trajectory of this development. And I can almost hear some people say, well, wait a minute, rendered the church defenseless? That may be where I would say it could be a little wrong in the sense that they could have been a little stricter with people like Schielebecks, Karl Rahner, Charles Curran, different church figures in those days that were rendering these problems and didn't act quite fast enough. But anyways, he's on the right track. I've got to say. So he says until the Second Vatican. Here's a key point that he's bringing up. Until the Second Vatican Council, Catholic moral theology was largely founded on natural law, while the Bible was cited for background or substantiation. So in the Council's struggle for a new understanding of revelation, the natural law option was largely abandoned, and a moral theology based entirely on the Bible was demanded. I certainly remember this in trying to compare and evaluate catechism books for grade school or high school, even religion books theology books that would be used in universities as well. And it was a common refrain at some of the meetings that we had when we discussed such things like this is that, this has lots of Bible quotes in it. This is well founded on scripture. And therefore it's really good. It will convince the Protestants of the Catholic way, shall we say. And so Benedict, that's a consequence. I'm adding that consequence, but at least the fact is clear that Benedict is pointing out that the foundation of Catholic moral theology, primarily on natural law and secondarily on the sacred scripture, is a great insight. And here he goes on to say he he remembers the Jesuit faculty in Frankfurt trained a highly gifted young priest by the name of Father Bruno Schuller. They tasked him with the purpose of developing a morality based entirely on scripture. Father Schuller's beautiful dissertation shows a first step toward building a morality based on scripture. Father Schuller was then sent to America for further studies and came back with the realization that from the Bible alone, morality could not be expressed systematically. He then attempted a more pragmatic moral theology without being able to provide an answer to the crisis of morality.
Wow.
There, that is
you
brain
just
wrinkling.
My brain, man.
Sometimes it's tough to hear winds of change over the air. What with tall buildings, power lines.
Oh, hey, that was Armin coming in there. Well, we'll get to a break in just a minute, okay, Nick? Let me finish this little part that Pope Benedict is pointing out. I never saw this connection so beautifully elaborated, but he's so right. Father Schuller was sent to America. I wonder why the people in Europe figured send him to America that he'll even go deeper into his studies. I think it's probably because America had the reputation of being a great country stooped in Protestant theology. So if any Catholic theologian should be able to borrow from or synchronize their teaching with Protestant theologians, it would be American Catholic theologians. And so, though he comes back and says it can't be done, makes me wonder, well, who did he talk to? He must have had some good Jesuit teachers like Father John Harden, for instance. He certainly didn't have some of the teachers that I had back in the seminary. Anyways, so in the end, we'll finish with this and then we'll get to our break, okay, Nick? In the end, it was chiefly the hypothesis that morality was to be exclusively determined by the purposes of human action. While the old phrase, the end justifies the means, was not officially confirmed, its way of thinking had become definitive. Consequently, there could no longer be anything that constituted, and here's the key part, an absolute good, any more than anything could be determined fundamentally evil. There could only be relative value judgments. There no longer was the absolute good, but only the relatively better, contingent on the moment and on circumstances. Doesn't that describe almost to a T what almost everyone, even the most faithful church-going Sunday pew-sitting people, right? It's the value judgments. I even get a little upset, or something sticks in my craw, or I like to use the analogy of your fingernails going down a blackboard. Well, you can't use that so much because most schools don't have blackboards anymore. We all have whiteboards, right? But when you ran your fingernails down a blackboard, it made a terrible sound and it made everyone cringe. I cringe a bit when the word values is the only word used in moral discourse. It's value this, it's value that. My values, we have Catholic values, you don't have Catholic values. Those are American values as opposed to non-American values. And the very word, what Pope Benedict is pointing out here beautifully, is that it's kind of charged with relativity. I value a nice hockey stick because I like playing hockey. I value a good golf club because I like golf. But if you don't like hockey, you're not going to value a hockey stick. And if you don't like golf, you're not going to value a golf club or whatever, right? Values are contingent on that personal experience that you carry with it. Interestingly enough, Pope John Paul II, one of his ingenious contributions is that he takes those personal experiences, which he calls the subjective reality of every person, and weaves a moral philosophy, moral principles that do not destroy the idea of an absolute good or an absolute evil, some things that are going to always be wrong, that you can't do something that is prohibited. And so that's where we're at. And so Benedict is pointing this out. So let's take our next break here, okay, Nick? And we'll come back and analyze more this very interesting letter by Pope Benedict as he was writing to the head of the bishops' conferences of the world. I'm Father Tom Coyes. You are listening. I'm guest host on The Winds of Change, and you are listening to the new EWTN Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland. We are WSFI, which is 88.5 FM, and WNDZ, which is 750 AM.
How long has it been since you have been to church? Busy schedule, work, or just lost interest? To be Catholic is not just merely attending Mass as just another weekend activity to be checked off the to-do list. Participation in the sacred liturgy gives you the opportunity to be intimately connected to Christ through the Holy Eucharist. You can also cleanse yourself of sin through the sacrament of reconciliation as a baptized Catholic. Come before the iconic monstrance to be in Christ's presence in the sacred silence of the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. St. Stan's is just off the Kennedy, 2 blocks north of Division on Noble. Come back to Christ through the sacred liturgy and his gift of the sacraments at St. Stan's.
We are the students. of St. Stanislaus Academy, and you're listening to the Winds of Change.
Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Sharing with you interesting quotes from Pope Benedict XVI's letters to the heads of the bishops' conferences of the world, trying to help us understand why we're in the crisis moment that we're at. And I, as someone who enjoys it or feels the import of Catholic moral theology, I'm very pleased to see this. He's pointing out that so much of the crises that we're facing, not only, obviously starting with the crisis of the pre-sex abuse of minors, but he's tying it to a general collapse of moral teachings and moral principles, as it were. And therefore, it's worth digesting what he's trying to teach us, what he's trying to tell us. He's going to slap some of the Catholic priests around, Catholic theologians, and he points out that in 1989, I was a baby priest back then, a whole bunch of Catholic professors of theology signed something called the Cologne Declaration. It was published, and it focused on various crisis points in the relationship between the Episcopal Magisterium and the task of theology. When I was in the university, one of the huge topics that a lot of the professors and students gathered their hope around was academic freedom. If a professor was teaching something seemed contrary to Catholic teaching, they defended their dissent by saying, well, this is a university, and at a university you can't prevent anyone from saying what we want to say. We have to have academic freedom, especially if you get tenure, then you can't fire me. And so out of the bishops who were sensing this bad teaching coming down the pike and teaching young college students, especially, oh, abortion can be right. Artificial contraception is your right, and it's responsible sex, as it were. Those issues were big back in the 80s. Now they've grown to transgenderism, gay marriage, and Now we're facing even transhumanism, right? You hear about that. Anyways, so back in the 80s, these professors signed something called the Cologne Declaration. You know what it reminds me of is the declaration that a whole bunch of priests, not priests, medical doctors signed in the days of COVID. I can't remember what university, or it was up in the New England area, the New England Declaration, and thousands of doctors signed a declaration asking, begging, cajoling Dr. Fauci to listen to some of their questions, examine some of their data, which they were being ignored. So anyways, that was, I would call that a good example of a declaration. But here, the Cologne Declaration, we got to see a little bit different. It was, they were pointing out this attack against theologians, teachers in the universities, by bishops. And they were hiding behind academic freedom. They have a freedom to teach error. As a matter of fact, that's an interesting connection to what Archbishop Vigano, in his critical way, addressing many of the problems of today, when he speaks of Vatican II, he often focuses like a light beam on one aspect of the documents of Vatican II, where he focuses on he questions what that document on religious freedom says, that there is a natural right to practice whatever religion you deem fit. And he says, if that's true, then there's a natural right to believe in wrong, to believe in error. So that's a consequence there. He would be in agreement with what Benedict is saying here. Anyways, he's going to point out too that those who signed it, the two of the signers were Karl Rahner and Cardinal Walter Kasper. Karl Rahner, for those of you who may or may not know, he is very popular, very, very popular writer and speaker. And he was kind of like, he's kind of has the reputation of being the brains behind Vatican II in some ways. He's willing to go along with this Cologne Declaration. And Benedict points out again too that Pope John Paul II knew very well the situation of moral theology and followed these issues very closely. He commissioned work on an encyclical that would set these things right again. So he collected some other theologians and he says, let's study what these theologians of the Cologne Declaration are saying and see if we can agree with them, see that we can't agree with them. And so he was gathering his troop together, as it were, and he was going to publish his famous encyclical called Veritatis Splendor, and he did so in 1993. And if you've ever read Veritatis Splendor, you realize how it is a challenging document to get through. But this triggered a vehement backlash on the part of moral theologians. Before it, the Catechism of the Catholic Church already had persuasively presented in a systematic fashion morality as proclaimed by the Church. So here again, Benedict remembers a German moral theologian by the name of Franz Bachel, who, having returned to his native Switzerland after his retirement, announced, in view of the possible decisions of the encyclical Veritatis Splendor, that if the encyclical should determine that there were actions which were always and under all circumstances to be classified as evil, he would challenge it with all the resources at his disposal. Benedict concludes by saying, here's one more interesting little quote, and then we'll go to our next break, okay, Nick? The hour is going so quickly, as it always does. Benedict points out that Father Franz Bachel, unfortunately, died in July of 1991. So God the Merciful spared him from having to put his resolution of challenging it with all his resources to rest. The encyclical was published in 1993, and it indeed did include the determination that there were actions that can never become good. So let's wrap up after this last break and see a couple extra connections. There was a wonderful gospel the other day that I have to connect this issue to, as it were. So I'm Father Tom Coyes. I'm guest host on The Winds of Change, and you are listening to EWTN, Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland. We are WSFI 88.5 FM and WNDZ 750 AM.
Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
I'm Father Tom Coyes, Winds of Change guest host, and you are listening to the Winds of Change.
Sometimes it's tough to hear Winds of Change over the air, what with tall buildings, power lines, and other static. Now you can hear Winds of Change anywhere, anytime, or on any device. When Winds of Change is on the air, Monday through Friday, noon to 1, go to ststanschurch.org. Scroll down to the Winds of Change tile and click on the Listen Live button, or visit Winds of Change Facebook page to see the Listen Live link.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Father Tom Coyce here. I'll see if I can wrap this up. I'm hopefully wrinkling your brain, but not too much here as I go through Benedict the 16th's letter to the heads of the bishops' conferences of the countries of the world. He's pointing out that John Paul II wrote a very important encyclical called Veritatis Splendor, which was a direct attempt to correct the problems of the people like Father Franz Bockel and to name a man from history, Father Charles Curran from Catholic University, where I studied actually, and many, many others. But there was that theological defense of consequentialism, an attempt to defend moral relativism at heart. And here's something that Pope Benedict brings into the discussion that I think we all should, and we have to keep this in mind, especially when tough moral issues do present themselves, and we all know that they do from time to time, and how do you handle that? How can you still remain a caring, good, tolerant, nice person if, well, let's see, we'll take an easy example. If you see that a person robs a bank in order to get money to feed their hungry family. Of course, there's the example in the Bible of King David going into the temple and stealing the bread in order to feed his troops. And of course, in a radical way, that's kind of how the Black Lives Matter people defended the riots that broke into stores. And however, truth be known, they were not necessarily robbing bread to feed their family, but they were taking flat screens TVs because they wanted them. It wasn't a really a good example, as it were. But anyways, we all know that there, at times there's compromises you make on moral principles. And so, and let's say a woman is pregnant with a baby, and doctor says if you don't abort, then you're going to die. That's a tough moral case, right? So what the liberal theologians were trying to say is, oh no, let's call the action of the doctor or the mother to kill the baby as a good. She's not doing anything wrong. And so we can't say that there's some things that you can never do And therefore, that does away with moral absolutes, right? So Benedict brings in the fact, and this is he's jumping off the teachings of John Paul II, that there's something called martyrdom. He rightly points out there are values which must never be abandoned for a greater value, and even surpass the preservation of life, physical life itself. God is more than mere physical survival. God is about more than physical survival. God is interested in our eternal survival, not just our earthly survival. A life that would be bought by the denial of God, a life that is based on a final lie, is a non-life. He goes on, martyrdom is a basic category of Christian existence. The fact that martyrdom is no longer morally necessary in the theory advocated by Father Bacco, etc., and all those theologians that signed the Cologne Declaration, it shows that the very essence of Christianity is at stake here. Yeah, if martyrdom as a category of morality is not usually contemplated, but you know, I think it has to be included in our discussions and debates, as it were. I often will tell somebody comes to me with a very difficult moral situation, and I know that, shall we say, the right moral choice would lead to terrible consequences for that person. I would say, well, it may be that you're called to martyrdom, but I also like to add quickly that God doesn't demand martyrdom of us all. He rewards it, but he doesn't demand it. It's kind of like related to the church's defense of Catholics fighting in wars. A Catholic can be a good soldier. To deny that reality is then to abandon yourself to the whim or the power of forces that are stronger, that are attacking your country. And therefore, martyrdom, which may include martyrdom or enslavement. You're either going to be martyred by your enemy or enslaved by your enemy. So those who fight in war against enemies of countries are putting themselves in martyrdom's way for the sake of the betterment of society. And that's, of course, why we honor soldiers who die in war, of course. But each and every one of us should be a martyr in little ways, as in big ways. What I like to tell my people at Mass, I try to remember almost on every Feast of Martyrs, and the Feast of Martyrs are always the blood martyrs, that we have to pray that we can understand what green martyrdom and white martyrdom is, so we don't have to experience red martyrdom. Hope you can understand that distinction. Maybe we'll come back to that another day. Anyways, that music means that we're over here. God bless you for tuning in. I am Father Tom Coyes, guest host on The Winds of Change. This is EWTN Catholic Radio, Voice for Chicagoland. We are 88.5 FM WSFI and 750 AM WNDZ. See you next time.
Meaningless thought, the shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time.